Breaking news today on Seculo as Jim Jordan subpoenas Georgia DA Fonnie Willis.
Keeping you informed and engaged, now more than ever. This is Seculo. We want to hear from you. Share and post your comments or call 1-800-684-3110. And now your host, Jordan Seculo.
All right, folks, welcome to Seculo. A lot to talk about today, and we'll take your calls as well at 1-800-684-3110. And you might say, hey, what's Jim Jordan doing subpoenaing the DA in Georgia? Well, Fonnie Willis, who charged President Trump with the election interference there in the criminal case in Georgia, it's not the issue that's been in the news most recently, which is the nearly $700,000 to the outside counsel she brought in that ended up being a boyfriend and the trips and the investigation there, which could sink the case on its own. This is a separate matter where federal funds, and that's the key, federal funds were provided to the DA's office of Fulton County when she was DA to set up a new program actually to protect women and young girls to process more of the rape kits that they were so far behind. So it was a multi-million dollar grant to begin a new program there. And they have someone in that office to implement that grant. But then someone on her team started using the money for iPads and started using the money for travel and unrelated expenses, even though the federal funds were very specific about what they could be used for and could not be used for. I mean, it wasn't like a very discretionary grant from the federal government. Literally, it's the grant said that specifically from the office. And when you look at the subpoena, it was federal funding, $488,000 for the creation of a Center for Youth Empowerment and Gang Prevention. And then another grant for the purpose of getting through those rape kits in the background there, Fulton County Center for Youth Empowerment and Gang Prevention to work with boys and girls aged 12 to 17. That was funded by a federal grant as well. So instead, they were buying MacBooks, swag, and using it for travel unrelated. So a whistleblower came forward from that office, someone who twice went to D.A. Willis and said, hey, I'm just trying to help you here. I think your team is using this the wrong way, and it could get you in trouble. So you probably want to put a stop to this. First time around, she wanted nothing of it. Second time it happens, that person walks in with a recorder device, and Willis again dismisses the issue, has her terminated, and is walked out with seven agents of the Fulton County DA office, armed agents. So now Jim Jordan and the Judiciary Committee have subpoenaed these documents relating to the whistleblower's report here. So again, on this issue, this is not about like saying, oh, we're trying to get involved in the Trump case and this and that. You either put forward a request for a grant or accepted a federal grant. And if you accept a federal grant, guess what you get? Federal oversight of that grant, and you have to use it properly. So again, she may try not to respond. They've tried to do this without having to send a subpoena. But now they have. So you see, again, she brought a lot of attention on that Fulton County DA's office, and it has led to a point where a lot of people speculating that the whole case involving Donald Trump and 16, 17 other individuals might completely crumble because of another matter, because of what she's involved in. And again, she had issues with this in the past before with other prosecutions and cases she brought because of what she was saying on a campaign trail. So again, we'll talk about that and take your calls on that at 1-800-684-3110. U.S. Senator Roger Marshall from Kansas is going to be joining us in the studio in the second half hour. He's going to be with me here in the studio where we talk about a lot of issues. So that's coming up. You definitely don't want to miss that. And of course, we are in a matching moment right now. Final 3 days. We have to file our reply brief to the U.S. Supreme Court in the 14th Amendment case. The reply brief due Monday. So we've got a matching moment, started yesterday. Great response. We've got donors that said, hey, we know you've got a lot of team members on this, getting this done. We'll match every donation, double the impact. a second. I'll get to take your calls. 1-800-684-3110. Do you think this could mean, again, Fannie Willis certainly thinks it could be the end of these cases she has brought, not just against President Trump, but others in Georgia, because of, again, there's already allegations, and that she's got some deadlines today on that, about the nearly $700,000 she used to bring in a outside counsel, which, again, it's not unusual to bring in an outside counsel. $700,000 is pretty unusual over 2 years to handle, you know, complex matters. And she was setting up the RICO situation there, remember, in that state case against President Trump and other defendants. And you come to find out that he's received, you know, nearly $700,000 over 2 years, these trips, an affair, salacious stuff. But now we know also that the Judiciary Committee has been watching federal funds that were provided to the Georgia District Attorney's Office as federal grant for two different crime prevention programs for them to set up. And they weren't being used for that. That they had someone in that office saying, hey, someone is buying iPads and trips and swag is the word they used. And the first time the whistleblower reported, like I said, to D.A. Willis, they were really doing it to say, hey, I just want you to know because I don't want you to get in trouble. She totally dismissed them. Second time around, she had the person fired. So it kept happening. I want to go right to Harry Hutchison because, Harry, this is kind of the second shoe to drop here. What's interesting on this is this has nothing to do with the case involving President Trump. This is about misuse of federal funds. And people have to always remember, if you, even as a state government or a private university, if you decide to take federal funds, the federal government gets oversight.
Absolutely. And I think it is clear beyond question that the Fulton County District Attorney's Office has been tainted, I would argue, with corruption. And it goes beyond simply hiring an incompetent, in my view, outside counsel to prosecute the Trump case. And so with respect to federal funds received, this brings federal oversight. And now Fannie Willis faces a subpoena. And the question becomes, can she wiggle out of it? And so it's important also to keep in mind that she has received several requests from Jim Jordan going back to August 2023. Essentially, Jim Jordan's office alleges, based on the claims of the whistleblower, that Fannie Willis misused federal funds, and that could lead to all sorts of potential penalties, and it should. And also, I think it adds to a firestorm which surrounds Fannie Willis with respect to her prosecution of the Trump matter. Parenthetically, of course, it implicates, at least potentially, the White House, because Fannie Willis and her alleged boyfriend basically had conversations with the White House before bringing charges against Donald Trump. So I think what we're talking about here is a tainted office, and I think Fannie Willis has not done a very good job of removing the taint. And nonetheless, she wants to be seen as what? A pursuer of justice against Donald Trump and other individuals, when, of course, she may have implicated her own self.
Right. I mean, in this now, it might to her seem like a pile-on, but when you bring this kind of attention to yourself as well, and when you're at the same time accepting federal funds, and you've got people like Jim Jordan out there at the Judiciary Committee who asked before the subpoena was sent for you to provide the documents without a subpoena. Now the subpoena has been sent. First time around it was, oh, you're trying to get involved in our cases and this is about Trump. This is again, separate from the nearly $700,000 to the boyfriend special counsel she brought in to assist in the case that she also has to answer for today. But also, I mean, not only is it a issue where the funds may have been misused, but potentially the wrongful termination of a whistleblower. What she's trying to say is it was a bad employee, but of course we know the employee had a recording device, decided to file this complaint a year later, and went in twice, and then, you know, was the way they were escorted out. So She's got issues directly, not just on how other people in her office may have misused the funds, but how she knew about it and instead punished the person who was concerned about it. Wouldn't even listen to them and say, hey, I'll look into it, make sure everything's all right, that kind of thing.
Yes, and so one of the things that Fannie Willis has to deal with is the potential that her actions constitute a cover-up of the misuse of federal funds. And so at the end of the day, here is a prosecutor with unclean hands who is trying to go after the former president of the United States, plus a ton of other people. Keep in mind, there are other defendants in the so-called Trump case that Fannie Willis has brought charges against. And so I think at the end of the day, the basic resolution of this case will require, this is my opinion, of course, Fannie Willis's resignation or termination by the state of Georgia. And the state of Georgia is beginning to look into her alleged misconduct. Now federal authorities should be looking into her alleged misconduct. And so I think at the end of the day, the taint that embroils her office, she will not be able to avoid.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those issues with all of this. And again, she keeps saying, you know, I refuse to recuse myself of the Trump matter and the other defendants there. But it's thrown everything off in Georgia. I mean, the whole issue of this being it was a highly complicated case. And again, brought it on herself because, as people were pointing out from the very beginning, she ran, you know, as one of those who said, I'm going to get him, and as a political person. And you point out here, there's not just federal, you know, involvement here, but many states now, I know Florida's done it. People might remember that with district attorneys and Ron DeSantis moves. That have empowered the state government there and the executive branch or the legislative branch working together with a committee can remove DAs that they believe are acting improperly.
I think that is correct. And there's still the huge issue that's outstanding, which is, what are Nathan Wade's qualifications to basically become a special counsel with respect to the Trump matter? Apparently, at least based on published reports, I see no evidence that he is indeed qualified, other than perhaps having a personal relationship with Fannie Willis. And I think most observers, most objective observers, would agree that that relationship standing alone does not constitute a qualification. And in fact, it may constitute grounds for disqualification.
Folks, again, we'll take your calls at 1-800-684-3110. Let's go to Jeff in North Carolina on line one. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to voice some frustration.
Sure.
You know, I hope that justice is served here and there are consequences for this misconduct. But unfortunately, you know, we've seen it so many times, just time and time again. They do what they want to do and there's nothing that happens. So, if that happens in this case, it would not surprise me that nothing would be done.
Well, I think there's two issues here. Does the case survive, and does the district attorney survive? And you could have one or the other or both. So she could go, and the case goes. The case could go because it's been so mismanaged by bringing the special counsel boyfriend. But you also have this other issue that she could go on, which is misuse of federal funds and improper retaliation against an employee of the state who was only coming to her to say other people who worked for her, hey, are doing this. I think you should know because I'm here to administer these funds, and they're very specific. If we don't use them the right way, we're going to be in trouble. They're not being used the right way. And so that then brings the federal government in. So, again, I never predict, you know, exactly, because I think you're right. I mean, over time, these, again, it's a subpoena for documents. It's to get information. I do think what we are uncovering, though, and exposing, and what is so important, folks, is what we're fighting. You know, I tie it to the 14th Amendment case. You know, we've got this deadline on Monday to file our reply brief because we represent the Colorado a Republican State Committee, so the party there. And we are party to the case, so we filed our initial brief. Now our reply brief, which is due on Monday. Harry's actually about to go joined a team of our attorneys in this office just doing a final kind of read-throughs as we work through it before, again, filing that with the deadline on Monday. But I do want to make sure you know this, that we've got a matching moment because our donors understand what we've been up against in these states versus, again, these secretaries of states, DAs, state officials that just want to, you know, remove President Trump from the ballot and have this power for the future as well. So what? They can remove whoever the most effective Republican candidate may be. And are Republicans then going to start doing that? And this is how we're going to do politics in America. We don't believe that should be the case. And we need your support. Our donors understand that. So they've set up a matching moment. Whatever you donate right now at ACLJ.org will be matched dollar for dollar in this ACLJ. Welcome back to Secu. I did kind of follow up on, so how exactly could this work in Georgia? And then we'll get to some other issues as well. And by the way, I want to let you know, too, we're going to be joined by a Senator Roger Marshall on set here with us at in the studio in the next half hour of the broadcast. So you don't want to miss that. Certainly very cool to have him here with us. But what can happen in Georgia? Because different states have different ways of handling this. For instance, the judge could take action and actually disqualify the district attorney, Fani Willis, in the matter. So he could do that. And then there is a committee in the state, and that committee would then take it over and decide if they want to even continue with the case or not. So this could, again, be extremely serious in how this affects not just President Trump, but those other defendants as well. I know people have got questions about what will happen, what would happen if this, but again, if there is a removal or if she is essentially fired from the case, there's a state council that oversees prosecutors and it could appoint someone else. That could take a while. A new prosecutor could look at the case and say, nope, I'm not bringing this. And again, you've also got the Georgia Senate moving to investigate whether Willis improperly benefited from state money. So you've got federal money issues and a subpoena from the Judiciary Committee, House Judiciary Committee, and Jim Jordan. You've got the state Senate looking at state funds. You've got the nearly $700,000 to the boyfriend's special counsel. And you've got now the funds from the federal government. I mean, I think, again, a lot of problems. Not just distractions, but again, puts forward more issues that just underscore the lack of seriousness of this case. And it's kind of just drenched in partisan politics, which is not what we want our judicial system to be full of. We can take one call on it before we talk about some other topics as well. So let's go to Deborah in Texas on line one. Hey, Deborah.
Hey, I do have a question on that Fulton County case.
Yeah.
And it's in regards to the co-defendants that requested the speedy trial. I guess they made plea deals and they did have sentences. If this case is gone, dismissed, killed, what happens to them?
I think they could probably motion to have their basically it'd be like to have the record expunged and whatever punishment, depending on whether it was community service or even I don't think any of those were jail, right? Financial potentially. That you would just make a motion. I mean, again, that's getting ahead of this because that's not just her being removed from the case. That's the case being totally dismissed. So remember, she could get removed, new prosecutor gets appointed. They could decide to continue the case. They could also decide to that this case is improper. And that, again, the way it was used and just needs to be dismissed. That's then would invoke those people who would then go in and say, this was all brought against me, false pretenses. I was pressured to do this because, again, I was facing what I believe to be is, these charges are potential time in prison. The list goes on. But, again, I don't want to get that far yet. I just think it's starting to unravel. Now, what we talked about yesterday on the show, the State Department has now confirmed that they are, in fact, looking for ways to recognize the United States government, through the Biden administration, a Palestinian state at some time in the near future. Take a listen. This is Matt Miller, the State Department spokesperson, Byte 8.
But yes, we are actively pursuing the establishment of an independent Palestinian state with real security guarantees for Israel, because we do believe that is the best way to bring about lasting peace and security for Israel, for Palestinians, and for the region.
Yeah, we are on this right now. We've actually prepared a letter already going to Secretary Blinken on this matter. I mean, first of all, the fact that they are, this is the time, it's like they think that right after this war ends, so if they're on the David Cameron, who is right now the former prime minister of the UK, who's now the foreign minister in the UK, who said they're looking at doing this after the war ends, and Israel said this war is going on through 2024, that they would like to have this acknowledgement of Palestine as a state to give them some kind of like political map forward. But how? I mean, who's going to be in control? Who's going to lead this? What are their territories? What are the boundaries? What about the fact that these are two territories that are not connected, with two different leaderships, and again, one that's gotten more radical with Iran, one that's gotten more radical again in, I guess, more of the Arab world, and not so much in the Iranian backed Shia world of the Ayatollahs, Hamas, but what they have both done, Hamas and the Palestinian Authority leaders in the West Bank and in Gaza, is become billionaires, the ones hanging out in Doha. And the political leadership, as they call themselves, the non-military leadership. And, of course, in the ones that are in the West Bank in Ramallah. But it's almost, I mean, shocking we don't say anymore really with this administration, right? But that while this conflict is ongoing, they are trying to appease, I guess, radical protesters on the streets by saying, hey, we're looking at how we can recognize a Palestinian state after the war's over. Who is going to be the leader? Who is running this state? Who gets to decide when there are elections? Because last time the U.S. supported elections there, that was the last time there were elections, and Hamas won them. And there haven't been elections since in the Gaza Strip. The West Bank, they stopped them too. So you've got, even if you wanted to do this, it's the worst possible time to try and set up some independent state. You now have the report too from UNRWA. Remember how they said, oh, they found 8 people, 1 was a leader, 7 were like lower level Hamas. There's a new report out that actually 1 in 10 of the UNRWA employees had connections to Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad. 1 in 10 of the 12,000 or 13,000 employees. And that 50% of the employees at least had a family member. So at least half of the employees had a family member who was involved with Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad. So this, again, it just shows you the absurdity of some of this politics. I don't know if they're doing this just because they're trying to appease their liberal base, that they're worried about not coming out and voting for President Biden as they're threatening to do in the next presidential election. But again, we've got to, and we are at the ACLJ, I want you to know that, as part of this matching moment too, in the middle of, you know, we're 3 days away from filing the case at the U.S., the reply brief at the U.S. Supreme Court on President Trump's eligibility to be on the primary ballot in Colorado, but all these states have tried to utilize Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to disqualify him so that you can't decide who to vote for as a candidate, that we've already are working on this issue as well. When it relates to Israel, you know we're representing still hostage families. There's a blog up on ACLJ. Our European team was in Spain recently and the UK with more of those families working on that issue. So you know, I mean, we're activated on all this, folks, which is why a group of our donors said we need to activate a matching moment for the ACLJ until that brief is in on Monday. So we have 3 more days to go. You can double the impact of whatever you donate online at aclj.org. That's aclj.org. It is very important, folks, as, again, we take on every one of these issues. We want to be the tip of the spear.
Keeping you informed and engaged, now more than ever. This is Seculo. And now your host, Jordan Sekulow.
Yeah, so we talked about a lot. So we've gotten through Georgia. We've gotten through some of the issues, again, involving, of course, what are the filing. And we represent the Colorado Republican Estate Committee as a party. So we filed our initial briefs, and now we have the reply brief due. That's the deadline is Monday. So we've launched a matching moment at aclj.org. So whatever you donate is effectively doubled. And again, that goes through Monday when the reply brief's in. You'll be able to see it at aclj.org. We are less than a week away from oral argument in that case, and I think probably around a month away to a month and a week away from a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court in that case. And there's briefs from all over, different people with different theories. I think that bottom line truth is there's easy ways for the U.S. Supreme Court to handle this that are very clear-cut, and there's more convoluted ways. Sometimes they choose the clear-cut, sometimes they choose the more convoluted. But ultimately here, we believe that this is about protecting your right to vote for the candidate of your choice, whether you're going to vote for Donald Trump or not. And in representing the Colorado Republican Committee, the future of how this could be utilized against other potential candidates. So again, another big deadline for us, three more days here for that reply brief. You know, this has been quick moving. We've been in, we were representing about 12 of these. So they were moving all over the country, state courts, federal courts, and of course, Colorado first to make it to the U.S. Supreme Court and on a quicker timeline. We also are about to be joined in studio with us for the final two segments of the broadcast. U.S. Senator Roger Marshall of Kansas, who is both a physician, who's very strong on life, and we'll talk about those issues, but also a military veteran, served as a captain in the Army Reserves, someone who also a small business owner as a doctor. We're going to talk Middle East. We're going to talk Israel, what's happened in the U.S. Senate. We're going to talk the border because of his role, too, on the Homeland Security Committee. So, again, it is going to be great to have Senator Marshall in the studio with us here. And again, practicing medicine for over 25 years. He's part of that pro-life caucus, which I think is, again, it's great to have lawyers know that we can go in and ultimately overturn Roe versus Wade. But it really does take those who are, you know, again, right there who have committed their life to delivering human life. And when it comes to him, he delivered more than 5,000 babies. And is why he's so strong when it comes to the sanctity of life. So I we'll definitely discuss that as well, because we know that we're in this moment in the country, and we've seen it happening across the country, in Kansas as well, where a lot of education is necessary post-Roe. And we've seen Planned Parenthood. We saw the abortion industry ready to go on how to kind of defame and confuse voters on whether they were constitutional amendments or state amendments, ballot initiatives, anything that was involving abortion. And again, I think that what that reminded everyone in the pro-life community is that we had that big victory on Roe. It's now time to take the time to educate voters, including Republican voters, many who consider themselves pro-life, on the dis and misinformation you might get when you're taking on Planned Parenthood, but also, again, just on the issue itself, that, you know, who's really, what are these laws really focused on? And so, again, it's always great to have U.S. senators joining us, but it's even better when they get to join us in studio for a couple of segments so we can hit multiple topics. And as you know, just through today's broadcast, there are multiple topics. When you've got the State Department saying, yeah, that's right, that report, we're going to try to recognize a Palestinian state. Great time to do that is right after one of the territories, the Gaza Strip, Hamas, who oversees it, launches a deadly attack into Israel and says, you know, this is the time that we think we can bring the world together to recognize a Palestinian state. The problem is that if the U.S. and the U.K. get behind it, the world might. And I think so. We've got a lot of work to do there. We'll talk to Senator Marshall about that as well. Remember our matching moment, ACLJ. We've got until Monday to file our reply brief to the U.S. Supreme Court, protecting your right to vote for the candidate of your choice, that 14th Amendment case. Go to aclj.org, donate today. Folks, welcome Welcome back to Secular. As I said through the beginning of the broadcast, it's always great to have a U.S. senator join the broadcast, but especially great when they can join us in studio for the next two segments of the broadcast. And we've got U.S. Senator Roger Marshall with us, or Doc Marshall, as you like to be called, from Kansas, who is a former congressman, now in the U.S. Senate, and for captain in the Army Reserves. And I think what's great, because we, of course, the ACLJ, the issue of life is so important to us. I actually wanted to start right there, because you spent 25 years as an OBGYN. And delivered more than 5,000 babies. It's always a very, and you've seen in Kansas too, at the state level, we saw after the overturning of Roe versus Wade, there's a lot of education that needs to be done now. And I don't think it's people who are, a lot of people are seeing ads and they are getting scared. So they vote in a way they may not understand who they're voting for. And what we all realize too in the pro-life movement is, yes, overturning Roe was a great victory, but that where there's a lot of education that we need to do, not just from the legal side, but also from the medical side, about amendments that we want to put through and restrictions that we want to put through. And this is not about criminalizing women or criminalizing IVF and things like that we've seen in the ads. But you can be the strong voices on that. You are those strong voices. I'm a member of the pro-life caucus. How difficult is it for you as a doctor, you know, as someone who did this? You sit there and you hear from the other side who doesn't have that training, just spewing off rhetoric when you've actually delivered, you know, over 5,000 children.
Yeah, Jordan, it's hard, and certainly they can argue with us on statistics and the law, but what they cannot argue about is my personal experiences, where I've been in the room taking care of a person that was giving an abortion pills. I, of course, never did an abortion, never gave abortion pills, but had to take care of the people with the complications from it. Yeah. And these patients are told that, look, you may bleed for 30 minutes, have a little cramping, and 3 days later, they're still bleeding and cramping and having pain, and they were told to go at home, but they end up in our emergency room and we take care of them. Yeah. And this administration, that's a great example, when their mantra is just pushing out this abortion pill, just like candy, but it has huge potential side effects, including the potential for fetal malformations.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example right there, because people always say over time, oh, it's so safe, it's so easy. But they use, they use COVID, they use these different excuses or reasons why to go around the regular procedures and say, oh, yeah, you don't need to take this under the care of a medical facility, more just do it at home. And we've said from the beginning, this is not how this was intended to be used. Even if you think this is okay, take out the abortion issue. This could harm women. This could kill women.
Yeah, so I'm convinced this is why HHS Secretary Becerra got selected, was how he circumvented the law to get this abortion pill out through the mail without a doctor examining a patient, which I think is malpractice. The centerpiece of the malpractice is over the phone, they're telling a doctor how far along they might be. And again, took care of 20, 30 pregnant women every day. Their first visit, on average, they're off about 4 to 6 weeks on how far along they are. This pill was meant, approved by the FDA, I think, for under 9 weeks. You give it at 13, 14 weeks, a whole set of different complications happen.
Yeah, so I mean, just bringing that kind of expertise to the issue, we need it. It's great to have that voice. So it's great to have people like you step up with those careers and say, you know what, I can add this voice to the public, whether it's in the House and now in the U.S. Senate. But you're also on the Homeland Security Committee, and I want to go to the Middle East, because we have an office in Israel. At the ACLJ, it's actually ACLJ Jerusalem. We're representing some of the families who still have hostages that are alive, or that we hope are alive, and we've also represented families who we know now that are hostages who were killed, and a few who have been returned. You've introduced a standalone aid to Israel bill four times in the U.S. Senate, and it gets shot down by the Democrats each time. I've even talked to friends on the other side of the aisle who are Democrats but pro-Israel, and who are just, and I say, what's going on here? Like, why can't you guys get this done? It's what is the problem? Why does the left feel like they just can't go out and support Israel anymore directly?
Bingo. So Israel divides the Democrat caucus now. I didn't realize that. You know, I'm not a politician. I assumed that this was a bipartisan issue.
Yeah, but we're always told that.
But it's now become, the colors are being shown now that this is a partisan issue right now. So you have Chuck Schumer going to a pro-Israel rally down in the Nation's Mall at 2:30 in the afternoon saying he won't sleep until Israel gets his aid. We were able to form a little parliamentary maneuver and forced a vote at about 6 p.m. And not only did he vote against the standard standalone funding for Israel. He got every member of the Democrat Party to vote against standalone funding. So we've got them on record now. And it's even a pro-Palestinian party now, what the Democrat Party has become. And I did not realize that.
No, I think even my friend, I'm not going to name on the other side of the aisle in the House, is just shocked by this, just how difficult it is, because everybody, like, you know, they go to all these pro-Israel events, but there are more of the pro-Palestinian side is much more emboldened now, not just to say, hey, we should be more fair, more equal, or look at these issues, and we need to figure out, you know, the human rights issues, but actually look, it's like, it almost feels like they are supporting Hamas. I mean, they are justifying the actions that were taken on October 7th. Like they somehow were justified in this horrendous attack on Israel and the Jewish state, which includes Americans and people from all over the world who were killed and taken hostage because of, again, information. And we see American young people, we see it in the streets yesterday, protest. And then we hear from our own State Department that they are considering trying to unilaterally or with the UK recognize a Palestinian state within a year.
Yeah. Jordan, I don't know how to respond to all that. I can just tell you this. For me, this is a spiritual and a personal issue to me. That since as early as I can remember, we were taught in Sunday school to support Israel. My mom and dad taught me to support Israel. We were raised on Judeo-Christian values. That's what this nation was founded upon. It was the first primers for the founding fathers. And now this country is leaving that, that the left has become this group of people who believe that they are God, that they know, that they understand science better than you and I do. They understand what's best for your children. They want to do things to our children that without our approval. So that's just who they've now become. And now they recognize these a group of murderers, slaughterers, as something that deserves any type of recognition rather than calling them out exactly for what they are and then ignoring the head of the snake, which is Iran.
I mean, I wanted to go right to Iran on this issue because we know, again, Hamas 15 years ago was not the Hamas of October 7th. It was not a good group. It was a terror group. They would still lie. I was there once when they finally Israel, because of the amount of rocket fire that was coming in, and most of it was getting shot down by the Iron Dome, but that was the early days of the Iron Dome, and Operation Cast Lead was launched, but it was a different Hamas, not in the style so much of ISIS that they kind of displayed themselves to be, because they weren't receiving as much financial support from Iran, like we just talked about, and you just mentioned. We now also have seen, you know, our own service members killed, and we're told we're going to get a response. We're told the response could be, you know, in Syria, and it could be in Iraq, but it'll be against, you know, Iranians there. So we're telegraphing, I guess, to any Iranian, you know, Revolutionary Guard generals, don't be in Iraq, don't be in Syria. But what do you feel about, like, I mean, I know that people, no one wants to go to a full-scale war with Iran. I don't think that anybody in the country, like, wants to just jump to do that without really thinking through, but We've got to be able to respond to this a little bit quicker, it seems like especially when, if there's going to be this many drones fired at our troops who are, you know, in the Red Sea or at these bases that we sometimes don't even really know about or think about, as these three were in Jordan, that, you know, if there's hundreds of drones being fired at these suicide drones and missiles that occasionally, you know, our defense systems are going to let one through and people are going to get injured and killed. And we have to respond in a way that Iran respects.
So Joe Biden has given us war through weakness. An old physician told me once a doctor loses their reputation, you never get it back. Joe Biden's lost his reputation. The enemies don't respect him, let alone fear him. Jordan, we need a three-pronged response to this. We need a military response, economic, diplomatic. The diplomatic is easier. We need to go back and finish out the Abraham Accords. Probably another topic for another subject, but how that indirectly puts so much pressure on Iran. Military response, you know, very simple. Remember what President Reagan did in 1988 in response to a similar action? He bombed the heck out of their oil platform, sunk three of their warships. We need to do something like that militarily. Iran recently launched three satellites, military satellites. Let's take out those satellites. Then we need cooperation from our friends. We need to be shutting around down the airspace. Saudi needs to shut down their airspace to Iran. A whole lot of things. Economically, this president has done a fraction of what we could do economically to them. And again, we need to get our allies to put pressure. We should talk about the ghost ships if we get a chance. dance. the ghost fleet.
Let's go to that. We got a minute left here, but we will come back. We're going to be back. We have another segment coming up. I want to talk more on this. Then we'll talk some on the border as well. But I think what you just walked through, because people, I say, well, now if we do something towards Iran, then it's full scale. And you just went through all these different options that aren't full scale war, and how we were on that path before by isolating Iran anyways through peace, through economic deals, and through flights from Israel to Gulf states, and that there were more countries that wanted to come on board there. So, folks, you don't want to miss more. We've got, again, Senator Marshall in the studio with us. Another full segment coming up. Stay with us at the again, on Seculo. Make sure you're sharing it with your friends and family as well. We'll get to the border issue. And again, go to ACLJ.org. Got 3 days left before we file the reply brief on the 14th Amendment case representing the Colorado Republican Party. We'll be right back. All right, so we are back in studio with Senator Marshall of Kansas. And Senator, we talked life and we've talked Iran. Tell me about the ghost ships. We were just mentioning that. I want to get to the border, but let's talk about that.
Yeah, so briefly, Iran has a ghost fleet of some 500 ships that they're flagging with foreign countries' flags and using that to smuggle oil. Not smuggle, just run it right in front of us over to China. So we need to stop those shipments of oil, strangle their economy, and then hold those other countries accountable too.
It seems to me on that issue about holding those other countries accountable, they've totally ignored these international sanctions that have been in place. They didn't do that before, or they weren't so bold at least. Right. But it seems like now that China and Russia, like you said, if it's clear, you know that these ships are their ships, and they do it, and we don't really do anything in response.
It is that simple. Banking sanctions would be another example that, again, let's not go after just Iran, but if you do business with Iran, we're shutting you down. That we have levers. We have had incredible economic levers here that we're not using.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the border as well, because this is what I'm sure, you know, again, as a doctor, the issues that have hit America, and I know a lot of our listeners, even in my own family, the fentanyl issue, and even inside our organization, the amount of Americans that this is now the number one killer of Americans between the ages of 18 to 45, the majority of it, again, the I guess the chemicals are being put together in China, and then it's being smuggled across primarily the southern border. If you just even taking out the illegal immigrants, just that alone, just the fentanyl alone is a number one killer. You think that would be enough to galvanize Congress and galvanize Democrats, but it's not.
It's not. I don't know how our president sleeps at night knowing that 300 Americans died today. 300 Americans died today from fentanyl poisoning. 100,000 last year. Every year we lose more young Americans to fentanyl poisoning than we did all of Vietnam. But yet our president is and our secretary of DHS unwilling to secure the border. We're losing a Kansan every day. And now we've emboldened the cartel. The cartel is set up even across the state like Kansas, all across the state now. And they're pushing what we're seeing an explosion of now is the human trafficking. The sex trafficking is now rearing its head.
Yeah, I mean, to go to the human side as well of who's being trafficked. So you've got the drugs that affect us, but then you also have these bad actors saying, well, if we get the drugs across, there's the human trafficking. And of course, we have finally seen major cities where there are Democrats leaderships say, like, you know, this is going out of control. You have the mayor of New York say, this could destroy us, but they open themselves up as sanctuary cities. And they ended up being the place where these people go. We've seen even the violence yesterday of illegal immigrants who attacked police and were let right out after arrest with no bail. I mean, and their actions in the street. It just seems like it's lawlessness, and it's no joke. I mean, it's happening in all of our cities, and like you said, whether it's the fentanyl affecting your community, a small town, or a big city. Or the immigrants and the illegal immigration overrunning, you know, the hospitals or the schools. These don't have to be partisan issues. These should be human issues.
Yeah, Jordan, you know, John Adams, second president of the United States, said that the Constitution was written for a moral and religious people. And I would contend if we don't have respect for the law, that's the true threat to democracy. And this president has created this culture of lawlessness from an open border to cashless bail to defunding the police. And we just see this over and over every day. So now it's an entire culture of lawlessness. And it all started there at the southern border.
Yeah. And it, we see the evidence. So the other side sees the evidence. They just, again, is it still, it seems to be hard for them to still make the argument that it used to be like, well, you know, that we used to, maybe they'd say it publicly, but, you know, we think eventually these illegal voters will become U.S. citizens and voters, and so we want to be the party that does that, so keep letting people in. But now with the out-of-control nature of this and the millions of people, the terrorists that are utilizing it, this is not all, we're not talking about all Hispanics here. We're talking the cartels, the fact that Americans are dying because of the drugs that are coming across. And yet still, I mean, do you see any hope for bipartisan solution, or do we have to have just major changes in our elections and more victories in our elections?
Yeah, Jordan, I think that no matter what Congress does right now, though, what really matters is who is in the White House. Yeah. Obviously, one president could close the border, average under 1,000 people crossing a border today. Another president, the same set of laws, has 10,000 people. That not only is Joe Biden willing to ignore the law, he's inviting people. He's doing everything in his power to bring these people across the border. That this is his mantra. He doesn't want to solve the problem. But Americans need to not let the left fool us here. This responsibility is on Joe Biden. No matter what happens, he could have secured the border yesterday. Don't let the media spin this here on folks over this next week or two.
You know, when you are in Kansas and you're talking to voters there, and as they're starting to think about, you know, this election, they've got the presidential primary going on. Because we've seen inflation, then we've seen immigration kind of go back and forth, but basically issues that are all kind of connected to economics and security. Like security at home, whether it's the drugs or immigration, and also financial security. And those the issues that you hear about when you go home?
I'm going to give you a couple of examples. So over the last 2 weeks, we've done some telephone town halls. 4,000 senior citizens in one town hall. Another group had 4,000 young adults. Both of them, their number one concern is the open southern border, safety and security. Right. But get this, number two for both groups is a threat to their constitutional rights. And then number three is now in the economy and inflation. And I think as the difference is between concerned versus worried about. What keeps you up at night? Yeah. Your economic situation, I think most Americans say, I'll deal with this inflation, I'll get another job, I'm going to make a change. But these other two issues, oh my gosh, they feel helpless and out of control when it comes to this open border and this just non-relenting attack on our constitutional rights by Joe Biden and the White House.
Yeah, it does. It seems to, I mean, I think this 14th Amendment case that's at the Supreme Court, it's again nothing shocking anymore. It's like the Palestinian state movement. That they're actually, you know, it gets reported yesterday, but then the State Department spokesperson, he goes up there today and said, "Yeah, absolutely right. We're working on it. We're trying to get this done." And you're like, of all times to say that, of all times to announce that, it seems like this would be the worst time. But they have no problem because they feel like they've got to play some politics with it because they might be losing some younger voters because they don't think that Joe Biden's tough enough on Israel, so that they want to now sound that they are working on this Palestinian state. But yet on it, and if you play politics with every one of these issues too, we're not going to get anywhere. But I do think there's hope. ACLJ, a final question for you, and got a minute left here. You know, we exist as a legal and policy organization because we believe it's worth fighting. And you're a U.S. senator, and you were a doctor before that. You in the House because you believe it's worth fighting too.
Absolutely. So we are the patriots, modern day patriots out here. And that's what we're asking people to do is stand up and be a patriot. Run for school board. Let's encourage young kids to go into teaching. Let's do all those little things as well. But we need to fight every fight from our freedom of speech, freedom of religion, sanctity of life, protecting the Second Amendment. All those are at risk right now at the White House.
Senator Marshall, it's great to have you in the studio with us. Thanks for being with us.
Enjoyed it.
You know, folks, again, and follow you can, Senator Marshall is on social media. So on our social media, you can follow him there as well, too. He's got great information there on his website and what he's working on, and we'll have that up today as well. Share the interviews. We'll clip it up, too, for people because we talked a lot about different issues, and that was great because when you're in the studio with people, you get to do that. It's easier than just talking through a box to each other. So it's great to have you with us today, and we appreciate that. Support the work of the ACLJ, folks. That's at aclj.org. On Monday, we'll file the final reply brief before the oral arguments on the case involving the 14th Amendment Thursday in D.C. at the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll talk to you on Monday.